Thank you for listening to this message from the pulpit of Coon Rapids Baptist Church in the suburbs of Minneapolis, Minnesota.
It's the middle of the night. You hear a loud bang downstairs that wakes you abruptly from your sleep. You're processing what you've just heard. Suddenly you're wide awake, and not only what you've heard, but now you're beginning to think thoughts as to what that sound possibly could have been. You're processing it more and more, and you're imagining that somehow it had to have been, it must be that there is a burglar in your home. You search frantically for some weapon, and you find behind the door some curtain rod that you've not yet put up in your bedroom there, and you slowly peek around the corner with your curtain rod, and you begin to tiptoe down the hallway and over to the staircase so that you can go downstairs to, no doubt, attack this would-be burglar. As you're listening and carefully going down there, you feel like you hear certain creaks and groans of the wood and the flooring, and no doubt there must be this burglar that's there in the room, there somewhere in your house, and you quietly step down the staircase, and you're sure that probably this person's going to jump out from behind the corner at any moment and get you, and you come closer and closer, and you round the corner into the kitchen, and there on the floor is that metal pie plate. And you, the night before, you had washed the dishes, and when you put it up there on the dish rack, you thought, well, that's probably not really safe there. It'll probably fall off, but oh, I don't want to dry a whole bunch of dishes, and you left it there. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, it finally came loose, went crashing to the ground, and you were for sure that it was a burglar, but it was just the metal pie plate. Sometimes, in our minds, with different emotions, sounds, feelings, scenarios, things that we're thinking, we are just sure of one thing. We're just sure it's this way. It just feels that it's got to be a burglar. It just feels like for sure this is what's happening. Our feelings can be very strong, and yet at times our feelings can very much mislead us. We could look in many other ways that our feelings mislead us. Feelings, though, we're human beings. God made us where one of the components of being a human is to have emotions, to have feelings. And here in the book of Job, we're looking at this man, Job, who suffered. And when he suffered, that no doubt included his feelings. There's emotion, there is pain, there is agony. He suffers in one of the worst ways, to one of the worst degrees known to mankind. We've looked at that suffering. We've considered that suffering. We've considered how Job initially responded to that suffering in chapter 3, and then in chapter 4 and 5, how Eliphaz talked to him and tried to give him some comfort. It was godly comfort. It was an attempt from a godly man to give him comfort, a man who believed in God. And yet we saw that Eliphaz was wrong in some areas. Though he sounded really good, he had some wrong views of God. And now in chapter 6 and 7, Job has 50-some verses of response to Eliphaz, to this friend, and to what he has to say. And what I want to do tonight is to walk through these two chapters. Of course, I'm going to try to be brief and just making some comments in helping us understand Job's response. And then at the end, I want to draw your attention to just a couple simple principles that we can gain from Job's response. And the title of the message tonight is How Godly People Might Respond to Suffering. How godly people might respond to suffering. Let's look at chapter 6, verse 1. But Job answered and said, Oh, that my grief were throughly weighed and my calamity laid in the balances together. For now it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. Therefore my words are swallowed up. Job says the grief and the anguish and the pain that I have and what I'm going through is just so heavy. We talk about scales, you know, in the bathroom we've got a scale and you can step on it there and it tells you your weight. And in those days, the scales and the balances that they had were like two arms, and you put your measurement of weight on this side, you knew how much it was, and then you could, on the other side, you could put your object, you were trying to figure out how heavy it was, and you had to get them to balance. It was a scale. And he says, here, if you were to take out a scale and you were to put my grief and all the calamity and the suffering and the anguish that I'm going through, if you were to put it on one side of the scale, let me tell you what you'd have to put on the other side of the scale. He says, he talks about here the sand of the sea. That's a lot of weight. That's pretty heavy. Someone reminded me, though, as I was reading about this, that the sand of the sea tends to get wet. And when sand is wet, it weighs even more. You get a big bucket of wet sand and try to carry it. There's a lot of weight there. The sand of the sea. And Job is just describing here the suffering that he's experienced is heavy. It's a burden that's upon him. And he tells us this is what happened because of it. The end of verse number 3, I want you to notice, he says, therefore my words are swallowed up. I wonder if any of you kids have ever been at the table and you're just super hungry. I mean, you're just feeling like you're practically starving. And so your mom sets a big plate of food in front of you and you take out your fork and you're just shoveling it in as fast as you can. And sometimes I ask my kids when they're eating like that, I'll say something like, now, did you taste the red peppers or the mushrooms or the onions or something that surely isn't in that thing? Just to see if they're even tasting it, because they're just putting it in and swallowing it, probably in whole clumps of cheeseburger, swallowing and going down without chewing it up or anything. We just have that idea of being swallowed up, just taking it in. And Job says, my words, I'm just swallowing them up. It's the idea of words that come to my mind. I'm just taking them in as fast as I can. Or we might even say, I'm spitting them out just as fast as I can. Any word that came to mind, he was just taking it in and speaking the word. He wasn't being super, super careful with every little word that he said. You know, sometimes when we're in agony, we don't sit there and write out this neat little speech and make sure every word is exact and is precise. Man, we read Job chapter number 3, and when Job opened his mouth finally after at least a week of saying nothing, we were kind of blown away by the intensity of Job's words. Job says, you know why I talk that way? Because the grief and the pain in my heart is heavier than the sands of the sea. And so I am just crying out. I'm just speaking these words, rash words, words without necessarily thinking of every little nuance to those words. Because his friends were kind of like, I don't know, Job, if you're talking this way, you must not be right with God. And Job says, no, it's not that at all. It's just that the weight on my heart is so heavy that I'm finally just crying out here. But he further explains why he has these words. Look at verse 4. For the arrows of the Almighty are within me. The poison whereof drinketh up my spirit, the terrors of God do set themselves in array against me. Job says, you know what I feel like? I feel like I'm over there and I'm the target, and God's got his bow and arrow out and God's shooting poisonous darts at me. And the poison is hitting me, and the poison is in me, and it's killing me, and I'm dying here. I feel like God is shooting at me with the bow and arrow. That's what it's like. Maybe we should have tonight taken the time to go back and really think about all that Job had suffered, but what an amazing thing for him to say that, to describe the agony that he feels. He feels like God is shooting at him. Verse number 5, 6, and 7 kind of go together, and he continues to describe some things, his feelings. Doth a wild ass or donkey bray when he has grass? Or loweth the ox over his fodder? The understood idea is no. You're going out there to feed the cattle, and I've done this many times on my parents' farm, and you're going out there to feed them, and when you walk out there with a fork full of hay or a bucket of grain, they may be mooing, they may be out there, you know, making noise because they're hungry, but then you plop it down in front of them and they start eating. My dad has about a dozen head of cattle or so, and we'd take a bucket of grain out, especially when our kids were really, really little, and we'd put down a little bit out in the field like that so they could see the cows, and these cows would come up and start eating there, and we'd dump a little more here and dump a little bit more there, and then the kids, they could go up there, and he had some really quiet cows, and they could pet the cows out in the pasture and stuff like that. But they tended to calm down a little bit, stand there for a moment, and they weren't mooing and stuff like that because they had something to eat. They were quieter. And what Job is saying is, listen, I'm loud right now because there's a hunger in my soul. There's a problem in my soul that you guys haven't satisfied. He He goes on and talks about eating a little bit more in verse number 6. Can that which is unsavory be eaten without salt? You know, you want something with a little bit of seasoning here and you got to put some salt on it. Or is there any taste in the white of an egg? You're going to try that next time, aren't you? Really think about it next time you eat an egg. Well, how much taste is there? I was asking my wife, you know, what are the things don't have a whole lot of taste? She said maybe tofu. I don't even know if I know what tofu is. But you know, what doesn't have a whole lot of taste? And he's talking here about what they have said to him and what they have tried to give him to eat, in a sense of how they've tried to help him, the advice of Eliphaz. And he says, I've eaten it and there wasn't much taste to your advice, to your comfort. I'm still braying, I'm still mooing because I'm hungry for some comfort. And what you guys have given me isn't much comfort. The thing that my soul refused to touch, the things that my soul refused to touch are as my sorrowful meat, my food that is described here. What's something that you don't like to eat? Any kids want to volunteer any answers tonight? What's something that you don't... Okay, Evan's going to give us one. Ham. You don't like ham. Okay, anybody else? What do you not like to eat? Lois?
Eggplant.
Okay. What do you not like to eat? Amos?
Fish.
Okay. All right. The things that we don't like to eat. And Job says, the things that my soul doesn't even want to touch... That's what I'm forced to eat. The advice that these guys were giving him, just, it wasn't helpful. And they're upset at him. Job, how come you're talking so loudly? And he says, well, you guys have not given me much that's really satisfying me. I'm still hungry for some better advice, he describes here. He continues to describe his feelings in verse number 8. Oh, that I might have my request and that God would grant me the thing that I long for. There's something he really, really wants. Verse 9, even that it would please God to destroy me. That he would let loose his hand and cut me off. Let loose his hand. We kind of picture God's hand in a sense as being up and all ready to go. And all of a sudden it's cut loose and just like smashing a fly or a mosquito. I just wish that God's hand is all up and ready and God would just pull the trigger, pull the string that's holding it up, and it would come down and just squash me like a bug. And we saw that in Job chapter 3. Job said, my suffering is so bad and it's so intense that I just wish that I could die. I really wish that I had never been born, or if I was born, that I would have died on the day that I was born, or if that didn't work, then I would just die any time now. Job isn't going to commit suicide. That's not on his mind at all. But he's really crying out to God in prayer, just let me die. There's nothing in his human way of looking at it, there's nothing left for him. He's lost all of his possessions, he's lost all of his servants, he's lost all of his children, he's lost all of his health. He really anticipates that he's going to die very shortly. I mean, his health has gotten so horribly bad. He has lost all of his popularity. He's been kicked out of the city. He's sitting in the landfill in the garbage dump, rejected, mocked, the book of Job tells us, by all that are around him, all that are there. He's got nothing left. If he could just die, he would escape it all. So that's what his desire is. He's crying out in this pain and in this anguish here. If he could just die, verse 10, then should I yet have comfort. It would harden myself in sorrow. Let him not spare, for I have not concealed the words of the Holy One. If I could just die, then I would finally be at peace. And even though I'm in sorrow, I'd be fine with that. I would be hardened in that direction. I would be leaping for joy to be in sorrow. I wouldn't care that I would go through all of this pain and agony if God would just squash me like a bug and I would just be dead and I'd be gone. And in his last statement of verse number 10, not concealing the words of the Holy One, he's still saying, I haven't done anything wrong to deserve this. I haven't done anything wrong. So he's crying out in his anguish and pain. Verse number 11 down through verse number 13, he kind of brings out another important point as he describes his pain here. The strength that he has to endure this. Verse number 11, what is my strength that I should hope? And what is my end that I should prolong life? You know, he's saying, if this is my life right now, why would I want to live any longer? You know, I'm absolutely sick from head to toe. I've been rejected by everybody in my community. I've lost all my fortune. I've lost all my family. Why would I want to go on living? What is my end that I should prolong my life? Is my strength the strength of stones? You know, do I have some massive stones that are going to give me some strength? We see out by the shorelines, big boulders and big rocks, and people use them in landscaping here sometimes up against the shorelines to withstand some of the forces of the water. He's like, do I have a stone? Am I that strong? Or another comment, he says, or is my flesh brass, metal? Is not my help in me and his wisdom driven quite from me? I don't have the wisdom. I don't have the strength. I don't have the help in myself. I don't have the ability to do all these things on my own. I don't have the strength to make it through all of this. That'd be pretty challenging to go through everything that Job had been through. And dealing with all that grief and dealing with all that pain, and he just gets to the place where he says, I don't have the strength to go on in that way. I don't have the strength to keep going. I'm not that strong. And Job has just described for us in these first 13 verses how bad his grief really is. It's heavy as the sand of the sea, feeling like God's got his bow and arrow out and shooting at him here. And the comfort that he has been given isn't feeding his soul here. And he doesn't have the strength to continue on his own. He's still crying out in his pain and in his agony. But in verse 14, that focus shifts a little bit. Now he's going to really talk about his friends. These three guys that have traveled a long way when all of Job's other friends and all of his other people and acquaintances in town have forsaken him. These three met together. They sat with him for a week without saying anything, and now they're trying to help him, these three friends that he has. And Job begins to talk about what kind of help they are or aren't in what they're saying to him. Verse 14, to him that is afflicted, that's Job, he says, you know, to me, pity should be showed from his friend, but he forsaketh the fear of the Almighty. In other words, you guys aren't right with God. You don't fear God like you ought to because you're not talking to me in a way that's helpful. You ought to be showing pity to me. You ought to be showing care and concern with the hardships that I'm going through. But you're the ones that aren't right with God. See, Eliphaz had started out his whole conversation by saying, listen, Job, your real issue is you need to fear God. And we know from Job chapter 1 and 2 that Job did fear God. That wasn't the problem. So Job turns it back on them and he says, if you guys really feared God yourselves, well, you would be the right kind of friends to me. He calls them his brothers in verse 15. My brethren have dealt deceitfully as a brook, and as the stream of brooks they pass away, which are blackish by reason of the ice and wherein the snow is hid. What time they wax warm, they vanish. When it is hot, they are consumed out of their place. The paths of their way are turned aside. They go to nothing and perish. The troops of Tema looked, and the companies of Sheba waited for them. They were confounded because they had hoped. They came thither and were ashamed. For now ye are nothing. Ye see my casting down and are afraid. Now, this is not something that we often experience in this part of the world. But Job used an illustration from something that they readily understood in that part of the world. And in that part of the world, it was in the spring times when the snows and whatnot would melt, the streams would swell. We have that part here, right? And sometimes the streams were black and muddy as the snow and the ice was melting, and there was raging water just going down through the little streams through that part of the world. But it didn't take long before all of that water would go downstream and go down through the sandy and the rocky soil. And as the heat of the summer would turn on, it wasn't long before the streams were completely dry. Completely dried up, and the water was completely gone. I have never been where I've gone down to the Mississippi River on a hot August day and thought, wow, where'd the Mississippi go? You know, there's always water in there. There's always a lot of water in there. Now, these probably weren't streams as big as the Mississippi, but they were raging streams, raging creeks as all of that water was flooding down through there. And people, travelers from Tema and Sheba, these big trading centers with these caravans would come through and they would be expecting, hey, we need water. We're traveling out through the desert. It's hot in the summer. They need something to drink. And so they're traveling along and they need something to drink. And they say, you know what? Last time I passed through here in the spring, there was this huge creek and we can get something to drink and we can get something to satisfy our thirst. It's right around the corner. It's right over that sand dune. We'll get something and our camels will get something to drink too. It'll be great and wonderful. And they crest over the hill. And the creek is dry. And it was a common thing. And people would just, they would die out there. They didn't have enough water. They didn't have any moisture, anything like that. Because here was this source of water that they expected to be there, that in the heat of it dried up and it was gone. And that's what he's saying. Hey, listen, when the heat got turned up in my life and things got hot, you guys were gone. I expected to find some water. I expected to find some comfort. I expected to find some help. But when the heat got turned up in my life, you guys are gone. That's what he says in that last verse that I read. You are nothing. The stream is dry. The water is gone. In Job chapter number 6 in verse 21, you're nothing. You see my casting down. You see how I've hit rock bottom. And it's interesting, and are afraid. Bible students are a little puzzled by that. Why would Job's friends be afraid? It could be that they were a little bit afraid of being too friendly to Job. I mean, think about it. All of Job's servants were dead. All the ones that were close to him. All of his children were dead. Everybody close to Job was dead. All of his other friends had walked away. And now maybe some of these other friends were thinking, you know, I don't know that I want to be real close to you right now. Because all of the people that were really close to you are dead. I don't want to be one of those. And especially if they thought that Job had sinned. Especially if they thought that Job got all these punishments on him because of his sin, they would be thinking, wow, I don't want to be close to this guy. He's not right with God. He's getting all sorts of punishments from God. I don't want to be near him. And there could have been some fear. There could have been some terror in wanting to be too close to Job. And he says, so you guys haven't been much of a comfort to me because you're afraid. You see my casting down and are afraid. Notice what else he says in verse 22. Did I say, bring unto me, or give a reward for me of your substance, or deliver me from the enemy's hand, or redeem me from the hand of the mighty? And what he's saying is, Did I ask you guys for anything? Did I call up you, Eliphaz, and say, hey, bring some money and help me out here? Did I call up you, Bildad, and say, hey, listen, the Chaldeans made off with all of my stuff and stole it from me. Would you come help me get my stuff back here? Did I ask you for anything? I didn't ask you for anything. So I can speak freely here. I didn't ask you for any favors. Here's what he really wants from them, verse 24. Teach me. And I will hold my tongue and cause me to understand wherein I have erred. You guys think that I've sinned. Okay. Show me where. And you guys are all upset because I've been so loud about my grief and my pain. I'll be silent if you can prove to me where I sinned, because I haven't sinned. So you teach me and I'll be quiet. Verse 25, how forcible are right words, but what doth your arguing reprove? In other words, he's saying, you know, if you say something and you say the right thing, it can have a lot of power here. But you guys are trying to reprove me and correct me here, and it's not right, and so it doesn't have any meaning. Right rebukes, they can have a lot of power, but not what you guys are saying. Do you imagine, verse 26, to reprove words and the speeches of one that is desperate, which are as wind? You guys think that all my ravings are just a bunch of loud, hot air and wind and breeze. So why are you reproving me? You think it's just a big bunch of hot air. Now notice what he says about them in verse 27. Yea, ye overwhelm the fatherless and ye dig a pit for your friend. You know, it's sometimes a little bit challenging to know the tone that these things come across here. Eliphaz kind of made a couple jabs in chapters 4 and 5 on Job. And Job kind of makes some jabs back here a little bit. Yeah, you guys, you're like a bunch of soldiers that go to battle and you capture and haul off the kids and you treat me like that. These innocent little kids, these orphans that mom and dad aren't there to protect them. That's what I'm like. I don't have anybody to protect me, anybody to help me, and that's how you've treated me. You've like dug this pit and I'm your friend. You've dug this pit so that I would fall into it here. That's a pretty strong statement that he's making to Eliphaz and his buddies. Verse 28, now therefore be content, look upon me, for it is evident unto you if I lie. You know, hey, look at me, I can't tell a lie. You know my face, you would know if I was lying. We've said expressions like that, right? I'm terrible at lying. You would know if I was lying. If I was really lying and trying to cover up some sin, you'd be able to tell. Be content with the fact that you know me that well. Return, I pray you. Verse 29, let it not be iniquity. Yea, return again, my righteousness is in it. You guys think that I've sinned, but you need to turn or return from that idea. I'm righteous here. Is there iniquity in my tongue? Cannot my taste discern perverse things? I'm not lying to you. But I can tell when other people are twisting things and perverting them and being dishonest in this matter. I can tell. Job is in quite a bit of pain here, and he's talked about his friends. He's talked about the fact that they haven't brought the comfort to him that he was hoping that they would. Chapter 7 is a little bit shorter. Let's just briefly walk through this, and then I'll make some points. Verse 1, is there not an appointed time to man upon the earth? Are not his days also like the days of an hireling? As a servant earnestly desireth the shadow, and as a hireling looketh for the reward of his work, so am I made to possess months of vanity, and wearisome nights are appointed to me. And so Job here talks about servants and slaves, and he says, you know, servants here, they have the end of the day, and they expect their wages, and they expect to make it through the hardships, and at the end of the day, have some relief, have some reward, have some break for their labors and the challenging things that they go through. Not me. I go through months and months of emptiness. Wearisome nights. My days are horrible, and when you would think that I could finally get some rest at night, my nights are terrible. Have you ever had nights like these? He's going to tell you about them in verse 4. When I lie down, I say, when shall I arise and the night be gone? Have you ever gotten in bed? You just put your head on the pillow and say, I can't wait for the morning. I just wish the night were over. Most of us don't think that way. You know, our head hits the pillow and we're like, oh, so nice to lay down. He was in such agony and such pain here. I am full of tossings to and fro unto the dawning of the day. He can't even get any rest at night. He's tossing to and fro, back and forth, and he just wishes that the night were over and that the day, he just wishes that the day were over. My flesh, verse 5, is clothed with worms. Remember, he's got these pussy sores all over him, and there's worms and clods of dust. He's sitting in the landfill and down in the dirt. My skin is broken and become loathsome. You know, you get this scab on you, and it gets all dry and hard, and then it cracks open and oozes out, and it's loathsome. It's disgusting. And he's like, that's what I'm dealing with as well. My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle and are spent without hope. I didn't know what a weaver's shuttle was. You know what a shuttle is? You have to look it up. It's a fascinating thing. You've got this weaving machine or whatever that they're using. We think back to, you know, 200 years ago or something like that, at least in my stereotypical fashion here. And you got all these pieces of threads that they're trying to make into some long piece of cloth or something. And they need to run a string through it. But instead they have this shuttle, and they can pull this cord, and the shuttle shoots through to the other side of it. You can get online and Google a video and watch it. And so the person that's the weaver, they're moving their hands and they pull the rope and it goes and it shoots through. And then they pull it the other way and it shoots back and forth and back and forth. We would say as fast as a bullet. But man, when you watch somebody who knows how to run and do this weaving here, you can barely see that shuttle fly back and forth. I mean, it's and they pull the thing and then and it goes back and it just flies. My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle and are spent without hope. He had no hope of the future. Would you? You know the end of the story. You read the end of the book of Job. Job is sick. He thinks he's dying. Every few days, things seem to get worse from losing all of his possessions and his children and then sickness. He's got no hope. Oh, remember that my life is wind. My eyes shall no more see good. That's it. Job says, I know I'll never see good again. By the way, he was wrong, wasn't he? The eyes of him that hath seen me shall see me no more. Thine eyes are upon me, and I am not. As the cloud is consumed and vanisheth away, so he that goeth down to the grave shall come up no more. He shall return no more to his house, neither shall his place know him any more. I'm going to die, and I'm going to be gone. He really thought he was about to die. He was hoping God would let him die real soon, but he really expected that he was going to die at any moment. That's how bad off he was. That's how sick he was. Verse number 11, this sounds like what we started with. Therefore, I will not refrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. I'm about to die, so I'm going to tell you how bad it is. Now he's going to talk to God in the rest of this chapter. Am I a sea or a whale that thou settest a watch over me? God, do you think I'm some sort of like, you know, wild ocean that you've got to guard me and watch over me? Do you think I'm like this whale or this sea monster down in the ocean that you've got to watch and guard me? I'm just Job. Why do you think I'm this way, God? When I say my bed shall comfort me, oh, if I can just lay down. My couch shall ease my complaint. Then thou scarest me with dreams and terrifies me through visions. He says, God, I just think I'm going to lay down at night and maybe get a little bit of rest. And then I got this dream and this vision in the middle of the night that terrifies me. Nightmares. So that my soul chooses pangling and death rather than my life. I loathe it. I would not live alway. Let me alone, for my days are vanity. He just says, boy, just crying out here in the anguish. Verse 17, he asked God, what is man that thou shouldest magnify him, and that thou shouldest set thine heart upon him, and that thou shouldest visit him every morning and try him every moment? God, you're the God of the universe. Billions and billions of miles and light years across is our universe and galaxy and solar system and all that stuff. And God, I'm just one human being on this tiny little speck called the earth, in this one specific solar system and all this stuff. I'm just one little speck on all of that. Why do you care about me? Why do you guard me like I'm some sort of sea monster here or this big whale here? Why do you just obsess over me? I'm just a little speck here is what he's saying. How long will you not depart from me, verse 19, nor let me alone till I swallow down my spittle? It's like, God, you don't even leave me long enough so that I can swallow. You won't even leave me alone that long, God. Verse 20, I have sinned. He's kind of saying, you know, maybe I have sinned. Let's talk for a moment as if I have sinned, all right? What shall I do unto thee, O thou preserver of men? God, I'm one tiny little speck, and if I have sinned, how does it hurt you that badly that you just came in and trounced me like this? Why hast thou set me as a mark against thee? Remember, he talked at the beginning. I'm like the target and you're shooting your arrows at me. God, why do you set me that way? So that I'm a burden to myself. Last verse. And why dost thou not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? He says, God, it feels like there's some sin that I committed in the past and I confessed it to you, but you're still holding it over my head, God. That's what it feels like. For now shall I sleep in the dust. I'm going to die and it's not going to be long. I'm going to die. And thou shalt seek me in the morning, but I shall not be. And he says, God, I'm just about to die. And I'm going to die. And all of a sudden, God, you're going to come looking for me, but it's going to be too late. I'm going to be dead and I'm going to be gone. These are the words of a man that's suffering. These are a man that's the words of a man that is going through quite a bit of emotions and quite a bit of incredible feelings here. And as we study out these words, we kind of just say, okay, God, why did you put it in the Bible? And let me just talk about this briefly, give you a couple quick thoughts, and we'll be done. As I studied it, one person said, as you look through these chapters, don't necessarily expect everything to be logical, like Eliphaz and the friends make a point and Job perfectly refutes it, like they're some sort of specialized debate here. These are a couple of guys sitting in the landfill talking to their friend and trying to give comfort to their friend. It's not going to be a perfectly ordered speech. Instead, watch for the emotion that's behind it. And that's why I tried to bring out the emotion that's in chapter 6 and chapter number 7. There's quite a bit of emotion that's brought out here. And when you see this emotion, it's going to be a helpful thing to us. It's going to be a helpful thing to us because, for one reason, it helps me to understand the responses of other people who are suffering. Sometimes we're not the ones suffering, but our friend, our relative is suffering. And when they're going through a hardship, when they're going through a struggle, they respond loudly. They respond in some incredible ways. They say some things that are a little strong. They say some things that are a little harsh. They say that they would just wish that God would let them die. They say something like that that's a little bit strong. And we're taken back and we're a little surprised at times by what they say when they're suffering. And here we come to the book of Job, and God prepares us for that by seeing here a godly man and how he responds. Maybe not completely perfect, but it prepares us. It also prepares us to understand some of our own responses. Who knows if in our future God would have us to go through some suffering that is so incredible, that is so intense, that we would respond in some of the ways as Job does, and all of a sudden we're shocked and we're just amazed. Where did that come from? I can't believe I'm feeling this way. I can't believe I'm wrestling with these thoughts and these feelings and these emotions here. And when we come to the book of Job, we see a little bit of that brought out, so it prepares us. Dr. Mays' work on the book of Job refers to a popular Christian of the 20th century named C.S. Lewis. You've probably heard of him. Evidently, Lewis married later in life to a lady who was sick pretty much the whole time that they were married, maybe just a few years. And he loved her very, very much, and it was quite a challenge. He was evidently, I think, in about his 60s when she finally died. He wrote about some of his grief and some of his anguish, a book entitled A Grief Observed, and here's just a couple little snippets of it. But notice what he says. He's a noted Christian writer, but he says, "Talk to me about the truth of religion and I'll listen. Gladly. Talk to me about the duty of religion and I'll listen submissively. But don't come talking to me about the consolations of religion or I shall suspect that you don't understand." From a Christian writer? He goes on to say, "Meanwhile, where is God? This is one of the most disquieting symptoms. When you're happy, so happy that you have no sense of needing God, so happy that you're tempted to feel His claims upon you as an interruption in your life, if you remember yourself and turn to Him with gratitude and praise, you'll be, or at least it feels like, wrapped up in His arms when everything's going well," he's saying there. You can just sense God's presence. "But go to Him when your need is desperate, when all other help is vain, and what do you find? A door slammed in your face. The sound of the bolting and double bolting on the inside, and after that, silence. You may as well turn away. The longer you wait, the more emphatic the silence will become. Why is He so present a commander in our time of prosperity and so very absent a help in the time of trouble?" I haven't read the rest of the book to see where he goes with that, but he's crying out in the anguish and he says, "You know, as I'm going through this pain and I'm going through this anguish, it feels like when everything was good that God was right there. He's my buddy, my friend and everything. But when times are difficult and I need God, it feels like the door slammed closed and I can't hear anything from God. It feels that way." Job cries out in some similar ways here in these chapters as he describes it. And How is it as we are working with people who are suffering that they can cry out that way, that they can feel that way, that God is so gone? They feel God is so behind a closed door. And so we look at these two chapters, and let me just say these four quick points. These people may have feelings about their feelings. As we look at how they respond, they have feelings about their feelings. He says, the pain is like the sand of the seashore that's just crushing in upon me. And he describes it over and over, the different feelings that they have. Number two, they may have feelings about their life. He described his life as being terrible. He described it, you know, I just wish I could lay down and get some rest. But as soon as I lay down, I'm reminded how I wish it were morning, because the night's going to be terrible. I'm going to have nightmares and I'm going to be tossing to and fro. I won't be able to sleep here. I just wish that God would really just squash me like a bug and let me die. They may describe that. Number three, they may have feelings about their friends. He says, you guys are supposed to be like a refreshing stream. But when the heat cranked up in my life, I came over the hill and you guys had nothing for me. You were nothing. And there may be people, as they go through difficulties and hardships, we don't have the right words, the best words to say. They may feel in a similar way about those that are trying to comfort them. But number four, and finally here, they may have feelings about their God. They may have served God all of their lives. They may have walked with God. They may have spent years in the ministry or years investing in God's work here. And all of a sudden they are hit with something that they say, I don't deserve this. I don't know why I'm going through this. And they feel like God is against me. God's got his bow and arrow out and he's shooting at me. I know that he is. And many times in our lives, we do our math based on our feelings here, and we say our 2 plus 2 has to equal this 4. It has to be this way, because I didn't do anything wrong, and God's allowed problems into my life, and evidently, God's not treating me fair, God's shooting at me. That's the only conclusion. But you've read the beginning of the book of Job, and you know that's not the only conclusion. Because Job had done what's right, and God did allow these difficulties to come in his life, but it wasn't because God was attacking Job, it was because God was attacking Satan, and he was using Job to accomplish that, in taking out Satan. And many times, the point that I wanted to start with, as I talked about that feeling in the middle of the night that there's a burglar in the house, we have these feelings, and we have these emotions, and we say, this has got to add up to this. This is the way I feel like God. Evidently, God's blocked the door. God's bolted it and he's not talking to me. That's how I feel, therefore that's the way it is. And Job says, I feel like God has treated me this way. That's the way it is. And in fact, Job is wrong. God's impressed with Job. Read chapter 1 and 2. Read 42. God's impressed with Job. God's not treating Job unfairly. God's doing a whole lot more. Just be careful when you have those times of feelings and difficulty and suffering and you say, therefore God's wrong. You might be doing the math completely wrong. You might be looking at God in a completely wrong way, because there's more going on than what you realize. Eliphaz is wrong. Job is wrong. C.S. Lewis is wrong in that feeling at that moment. And though it may feel like the door is bolted, in fact, we know from Scripture and we stand on it that he says, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. That his ears are open unto our prayers. That we can cast all our care upon him, and he does care for us. Regardless of how we feel, regardless of how the circumstances come about in our lives, we know that God truly does care. Be careful when you get mad at God. Be careful that when you are just sure that God is acting toward you in a wrong way, because you don't know the whole story. We're human creatures. We have feelings. We have emotions. We're going to go through there and we're going to respond in some of those emotional ways. But we have to handle our feelings carefully and stick with what we know about God from the Word of God. And Job gives us a very sobering, challenging reminder and teaching about the importance of having the right understanding about God, even when we may feel that everything else is pointing in a different direction. And so Job here, we look at how this godly man responds. Not maybe perfect, but certainly real, and we understand the sufferings that he goes through. I hope that it's a help to you tonight.
Visit us at 11164 Hanson Boulevard or online at coonrapidsbaptist.org.